Welcome to the Once Upon a Leader in Africa podcast with George Nudu. We invite you to listen to influencers and opinion shapers narrating their experiences from their leadership roles in Africa, from the world of business, community development, government, corporate, social enterprise, among others. We will glean from their good, bad, and ugly side of their leadership journey and be inspired to overcome adversity, to pursue success against all odds, to be a great leader, and many other lessons. Welcome to the podcast, and here's George Nudu.
Hello, Cecily, how are you?
I'm very well, George. Thanks for having me today.
And thanks for honoring me and my listeners by being present today. Thank you so much. I really do appreciate that.
My pleasure, enjoy.
So let's start from your current leadership role that you're executing. I know I've been seeing you on the LinkedIn, on your social media, having various leadership talks and all that. So what makes you do that?
Thanks for asking. And you know that after being in the public spaces for over two decades, there is that which one acquires by way of leadership experience that you live through. And when I left the public spaces, I thought I needed to package the experiences that I had picked over the 20 years and share it with people who may benefit by listening to the opportunities that I went through, but also the missed opportunities that I would perhaps, given a chance, execute differently as a leader. And so I got out really to share my lived experience with emerging leaders and current leaders in the public spaces, in the sectors where I've been, in the private sector where I've also been privileged to have served, and just let it be known, you know, a journey of one Sicily in leadership.
Briefly, just tell us what the roles and positions you've held in the past, those two decades.
So if I start where I am currently, 2 years ago, I founded a company. We are involved in executive leadership coaching. I've also been certified this year as an emotional intelligence practitioner. And combining that new skill set now with my lived leadership experience, I thought founding a company and a structure that I'm able to communicate and brand the services that I am currently giving would be a logical first step for me to come into this space. And therefore, my company, where I am the CEO and founder, is called Reimagine Impact Associates Limited. I like to underline Reimagine Impact because that, for me, is so important. If every leader given a chance to lead can imagine or reimagine the impact they would want to have in this world, I think that would have a much better world. And therefore, for me, the brand name is telling of what I believe to be one of my legacy statements that I would want to be remembered to when I vacate this space. And so I have been working with emerging leaders. I've been working with newly appointed CEOs. I've been working particularly with leaders in the medical space. It's strange, because I spent well over 2 years there, and we made bonds that when they've come to know what I am doing right now, they reach out to me and they refer, others refer others to me. And therefore, I'm graduating from being their mentor, because most of these young leaders in the health sector, for example, I did mentor them. And therefore, I'm graduating them from being their mentor to now being their leadership coach. And so one of the other things that I do parallel to now running this coaching and emotional intelligence assessments and also coaching is to train whenever they are in groups. When they come in groups, I do train these leaders in a sit-down setting. I also am involved in strategy design and policy design and implementation through the same company. I'm also involved in keynoting and facilitation of training programs where my passion then meets with the issues at hand that I have just explained. Parallel to that, I chair a board of a non-governmental organization. We call it the Noni Kariuki Foundation. It's a family foundation that we founded 3 years ago as a legacy project for my late daughter, our late daughter, who was called Noni. And so I chair that, and through that, we take very, very vulnerable children to school. We also empower women and youth through mentorship. And importantly, we also undertake health promotion programs specifically on menstrual hygiene. And so 30% of my week, that is what I am doing, and that is where I'm dedicating my time and space. Now, George, you asked me about my 20 years. So if I start where I am right now, I will then move backwards and say, I resigned from cabinet last February. That was the year 2022. And I resigned from cabinet following a negotiation with my boss, the then president, to go and vie for an elective position as a governor. Now, that even surprised me. That surprised me. But I did believe that we as leaders, I've been so close to political leadership that I say to myself, there must be a different template of leading as a politician. You know, because I must say I don't quite admire, you know, the political leadership and the brand that it's all dirty. And I can tell you it's all dirty. And so I did resign after some lengthy negotiation with the boss. I did go to Nyandarua, my county, and I also did go after doing some objective surveys in terms of what are people saying or thinking about one Cecily Kariuki as their head of county government. And so it was all favorable. And when my family saw the objective result, they actually all supported that I could resign. It was very risky, but it's one of the risks that I've had to take, again, to advance my leadership journey. And I did go to the ground, and the ground treated me very well, extremely well, actually, given that I was not running on the party of the current government, which finally won. But, you know, into 2 months of being on the ground and, you know, dancing on the tracks and being with the people, I was asked to forgive or to forego my interest. And that was at the point of nomination. So there were two of us, the incumbent and myself as a starter. And therefore, when the boss called and asked me to reconsider and that I could go back to my cabinet position, I thought that I was going to pay a very expensive price in politics, the price of loyalty, because there is no loyalty in politics. You know, with a very heavy heart, because of the emotions and the resources that I had invested, I did pay the price of loyalty. And I said, if that was the last price I was going to pay as a cabinet minister, that I then paid it. And of course, it hurt a lot of people. I kind of was at the center of the decision, so I was less hurt because I then had about 4 days to negotiate the position of leaving. And my family and my followers were extremely very hurt when finally I announced that I had suspended the journey. So already the reason I resigned to go into elective politics, I was already proving that there can be a different template, that there can be loyalty coming alongside a political debt, which is very unusual. And so I was asked by my boss then to go back to cabinet. Recall 2 months before then, I resigned, and it was loud. It was so loud because I spoke with the media as I was leaving. I spoke with my whole family at the ministry, and everybody knew that I had resigned. And so while I didn't tell my boss on the face that I was not going to go back to cabinet, I knew it was going to be one of the worst things that I would have done. It really would have destroyed my many years of, you know, what I consider integrity. And so I came back home, broke, with an offer to go back to cabinet where I was going to earn my salaries like nothing had happened, where I was going to get by my security, my, you know, the trappings of power in cabinet, where I was going to feel the power one more time. At that point, it was going to actually professionally and personally just destroy me. So I said, I can deal with the brokenness. I can deal with the, with being a citizen, which I was beginning to enjoy. But I quickly, very, very quickly had to reinvent myself so that I don't go into a pity party, because my family was already beginning to pity me and wonder, how is my tomorrow going to look like? You've invested so much. You've even sacrificed for this country. Now you've sacrificed, you know, because of your boss. And they were beginning to be sorry for me. But at the back of my mind, I knew that I would pray and that there would be a way through. And I remember assuring them that I'll be fine. You know, I'll be fine. Just mind your space. Thank you for your support. Sorry I let you down, but I'll be fine. Don't sit and spend a sleepless night. And so as if the hurt was not bad enough, I actually went back to support one of the presidential candidates because he asked of me to support him, to use my structures, to use the people that are supporting me, to use my investment, which was quite a bit on the ground. And so, you know, again, I quickly went back and wanted to also prove to me that I you know, I can be resilient. I can go back there. But it was also an opportunity for me to go back to my people and to explain to them what had happened. I thought that way I wouldn't lose their trust altogether. And therefore, I used that mechanism and it worked. Before then, I resigned from the office of the cabinet secretary for water, sanitation and irrigation, a space I sat for about just slightly over 2 years. And before that, I had just moved from being the cabinet secretary for health, a position I held until January of 2020. 14th of January is when the president deployed me to the water sector. And as he deployed me, the gentleman who was to take over from me had to go the vetting processes in parliament. And therefore, I held two dockets. I remained in health at the onset of COVID. And I also was minding my orientation in the water ministry. But I chose to remain in the Ministry of Health because then it was burning there. You know, so for about 2 months, I was holding both dockets and I learned quite a lot. I learned how there are similarities in the decision-making, but how seamless government is a conveyor belt. Because as I was dealing with COVID and water was a critical issue, then I could reorganize the budget in the water ministry to be able to provide water, at least in the public spaces. And therefore, it was a very interesting transition for me. Before I was reappointed to cabinet in the capacity of Ministry of Health, that was January 26th of 2018. Immediately, the president secured his second term as a president. And in between, I had served as his minister or cabinet secretary for public service, gender and youth between 2015, end of 2015, now until January 2018. So I was quite involved with the transition, the politicking around the transition and helping him to secure a second term. And therefore, I got very close to politics, active politics, because I was all over the country popularizing my boss and, you know, popularizing the party and doing something that I really enjoyed with the youth and women in the villages. And that, I guess, is what sparked my interest again to go back into elective politics as a personal level. Before that, for 2 years, I was a principal secretary for agriculture from 2013 to 2015. That is immediately President Uhuru took over power, and therefore I joined his government as that role. And then I kept moving. Every 2 years, kind of, I moved to a new docket, and I did what I think I was made to do. I led teams. I enjoyed leading them. I made sure I left a footprint. and I moved on. But before I was in the government of President Uhuru Kenyatta, I was the chief executive officer of the Tea Board of Kenya during the realm of President Kibaki, Mwai Kibaki. And I served for round about 7 years as a CEO, regulating the tea sector, promoting tea commodity into world markets, and yet running the organization and growing it from where I had picked it in 2006. And I had joined the tea board from being a CEO of a private as members association that was responsible for growing, ensuring quality and safety of horticulture, fresh horticulture and floriculture products, and getting it to the world market. Again, a role I held as a CEO of this organization, the Fresh Produce Exporters Association of Kenya, for about 8 years. And before that, I was an investment promotion manager in the then KenInvest. Now, KenInvest now, it was called Investment Promotion Center. That was my first employer. I joined straight after university in 1990 as an officer. And then a couple of years later, I was privileged that there was a vacancy and I was promoted to be a manager. And I moved around the world really looking for investors. And that's what I have been from a point of plotting a career path.
Wow. Quite a good path. If you had to look back, I like asking this question, which was your first leadership responsibility?
That was investment promotion manager, because then I was responsible for a department that had human resource that I was guiding and kind of inspiring to get going towards targets that were set at the corporate level. So that was in 1995.
What about before, in school, in high school, in the family? Looking back, even before you started working, any leadership responsibilities and roles?
Yes, at home. I mean, at home, my sister would make you laugh when she says, my mom used to travel to come to be with my dad who lived in Thika. She traveled from Embu quite frequently. And there are seven of us at home and we were left there. I am the second last born, but only I could be trusted to serve food when it was scarce, because everybody would get the share that they wouldn't feel there is inequality. Never mind, I had five of my siblings were older than me. They wouldn't risk. Wait till there was one cock, a chicken has been slaughtered and is only one and there are seven of us. And you know how chicken moves.
Oh, that's interesting. Okay, that's when your leadership, you can say, began, when you said serving the food that was scarce in the family.
Absolutely, because everybody was happy with my skills and I was very young and,
Okay, that's interesting. Wow.
But before within that time, really, when I was in lower primary, quite young, my father's home neighbors, one of the prominent former late ministers, Jeremiah Nyaga, and because we didn't have cows, we had to go and buy milk from the minister's homestead, and I was the one who would be trusted to go and collect the milk. And I was very young, and going to see this palatial home and milk that I was carrying almost every day got me wondering why there is inequality in this world. Why don't we have a cow, kind of? Why don't we have a big house like those guys? And why, why and why? And every time I came back home, my mom had a problem trying to answer some of those questions, because I didn't understand why I'm from such a humble space. I don't even have to go fetch getting milk every day. And so I began questioning some of those value systems when I was very young. But at the back of my mind, I say to myself, one day I want to have a house like that. One day I want to also have a lifestyle that looks like that, because why not, And then maybe a third example of when leadership was showing, but I couldn't quite tell, is when I loved drama. I mean, I love humor. I love even today, if I sit the three of us, I laugh to crack jokes and I laugh to laugh. And so I was making the children in my primary school, and I sat in the same class with my brother in Thika Primary, because then I had moved from the village and I was in Thika. And I was making jokes every time this mathematics teacher was doing things, and I thought he wasn't being too useful. And, you know, I would crack jokes, and then he turns back and I'm so serious and I'm writing. Nobody could tell. So until he turned and he got a hold of me giggling, and he actually came with a cane. You know, a cane those days was normal. But he wouldn't cane me. I mean, I got onto the windowsill and I very quickly took off and I ran away, because he had no right to beat me. You know, it was just a joke. You know, I didn't quite pick a lot of leadership responsibilities, but something was showing. And every time I muted it, because I joked a lot, I liked to just be on the other side of being cheeky.
Oh, that's interesting. That's interesting. So as you work as a leader over this period of time, what are some of your leadership traits that you have relied on to be effective in your roles?
From my reinvention last year after a major loss, and I say I lost three things. I lost by resigning from cabinet. It's not usual. And then I lost from pursuing my dream of elective office as governor, which was so, so obvious that it was going to be fine. And then I lost because the candidate who I supported for the presidential race lost. So I had three losses within 6 months. And, you know, that is major. And in the process, I lost a lot of resources, the emotional investment I had made. My family didn't think I was okay. So I was actually going to lose even relationships. I quickly had to reinvent myself. And that for me presents a very, very positive energy. I'm driven by positivity, because I don't want to sit there and just be sorry for me and sorry for what happened. And that is something I have picked all the time. I am also quite focused. I mean, if I put my eyes on something, when I came to enroll for a diploma in executive leadership, I mean, nobody believed. You've been a minister. What are you doing sitting here now? You know, with people who have not even led beyond a unit. And I tell you, for the duration that I was sitting through the program, I was so very dedicated. Because again, I was focused. I knew I wanted to fortify my lived experience with certification and a new skill set that would then help me to brand or rebrand. And the same happened when I enrolled for my emotional intelligence practice certificate. People are like, oh, she's a minister. And then they'll be quiet and try to make the reference. Whenever there is a question, they are saying, what do you think? And I told them, I don't think. I mean, I don't think. You know, because it wasn't Cicely, the cabinet minister. It was Cicely who was beginning a reinvention journey in this space. So I'm also very, very focused. I would also say that I'm a risk taker. I can get on a window seat in a classroom and just go away. And I know that I was going to be caned. Because even that evening, I was caned at home, you know. So I take risks. My journey through the jobs that I've held also tells you somebody who moves from a permanent and pensionable job in government at a very young age, and I go to the private sector for a contract job without knowing what the future will look like. And it's important for me to also say that I'm very agile. And thank God, I think my boss must have noted that the one of the most flexible people, you know, is me. And that is why I move from this ministry. He says there is trouble there. In NYS, you know, is a troubled organization, go stabilize that. And then quickly he wants to implement his health agenda. I have never been anywhere near the ministry or medical, except when I was going to see a doctor and he thinks I can go and run that. And he gives that, gives me that. And then he wants to fix a few things in the water sector. So I'm a very, very agile person, but I'm also very accountable. Person, because when you're in the public sector, one of the challenges is how transparent and accountable you are and how much you're willing to be criticized and also say, you know, I made a mistake, and therefore, you know, bear with me because of 1, 2, 3, 4. So I am that and a few more others. And I think for purposes of the discussion with you, that will suffice for now.
In terms of challenges, I know you've shared quite candidly some of the challenges that you have faced. What more things can you say in just your leadership journey? What are other challenges that you can share with us and how you overcame them?
I think that going against the grain, especially in the public sector, is not only risky, it is actually illegal. And so when you find a certain culture and you are being inducted into a culture that is what you call cartel behavior. And if you look at the ministries where I've been, I think you people out here know what happens perhaps around the NYS, what goes on perhaps in the health ministry, and generally right now what we are seeing also in the public sector. When you go against the grain and refuse to be recruited, you of course are branded an enemy of the people. And I was branded an enemy of the people because outright, I would actually tell you, you try this, get out through that door. And the next thing was an impeachment being staged against me. And it almost went through, really. It almost went through because I don't recall another minister who was taken through an impeachment until the third reading before the parliament. And, you know, at some point, the president would wonder, is it that I am trusting you and there's something I am missing about you as a leader, as my minister? And at one time I actually offered, I told him, no, you find anything the matter. In fact, right now, I really have no problem. I'll resign and go home, you know. and if that will make you being a president look better, because it will also save me, because my family is completely struggling. Because, you know, they're wondering what has happened. Did I get recruited and then I didn't let them know? Have I become a different person? Has my value system, you know, turned 180 degrees? So people could understand. Only I could understand myself and perhaps my mother. Only I knew. And so I was very confident, because that's also another trait of me that my father and mother helped me to inculcate when I was very young. If I believe in a cause, I'll be confident about it. You won't stop me. I will climb through the roof and I will go if I believe it to be the right thing that I'm doing. And so I did offer, perhaps if I left cabinet, if it was going to be better. But of course, you know, over time, the president quite knows, you know, the kind of people that he had, you know, put in office. And so that was, for me, maybe the most optimal challenge in the public sector. The other one, which I think is worth documenting, is the culture that you find in terms of not going beyond the call of duty, you know, just doing just what it is you need to do, especially because when you're permanent pensionable, you are assured, even if you messed up, the process of getting you out will take the next 3-4 years. Nobody has 4 years to take you out. So you quickly come and decide, I am not going to put my energy dealing with people who will not perform or who are negative in terms of the vibes they bring into the space. I'm going to allow them to remain there as furniture remains in situ. And I'm going to choose the ones that I know we can align and I progress my business. And that is how I survived, because 2 years is a very short time for you to try and reorganize everything, to even try and work on a culture, to even try and get people. By the time people know you is into 6 months and, you know, they are sabotaging one side or the other. So you move, you get people who you aligned and you just get going. That's how I did overcome that. The one of being impeached, I would do exactly what I did then. I'll make the same decisions that I was, you know, being hit about because they were the right decisions for the country and for the people. And I will wait until I'm being impeached again. If that is again the price to pay, it's also fine.
Well, thanks for sharing that. You seem to enjoy, I know right now you're enjoying the space that you are in, but even in your journey, what are some of the things that you enjoyed because you were a leader?
I enjoyed a couple of things depending on the situation I found myself in. I enjoyed myself in my last assignment, coming in and moving myself from being a cabinet minister to being a coach and to spending quality time with my direct reports and helping them interrogate their value system and ask questions around themselves, which were what if. And my first question was, what if we were able to deliver water to a resident in this village in a 10% of the time that you are using? If you are using 1 year to deliver water to a village, water from a borehole, what if you reminded yourself that that person who is a taxpayer deserves water inside 1 month? Is it possible that that can happen? And believe you me or not, that really did happen. They went back and discussed with themselves and say, what did she actually ask of us? Is it possible? And 2 weeks later, they come back to me and say, by the way, it's possible. We never had somebody to challenge us to look at things in that manner. And that is why within a record time, by the time I left the ministry, there were over 600 water projects across the country complete. I built a team that wanted to just be asked and encouraged, motivated, inspired, and be able to kind of move. So I did, you know, convert myself to be that kind of a leader. In the water, in the health ministry, what I enjoyed most was getting myself very young, very technically competent officers to become my advisors. Again, nobody had ever thought a whole minister, what, you have so many young people around you. And it's because I had discovered innovation, creativity, and courage is more with the guys who have not followed the beaten path, because they are more daring if you give them a chance. And I allowed them to freely come and have conversations with me. And almost every other Friday that I was around, at 4 o'clock, my office would be open and I would have 10, 12 of these young people taking coffee with me, taking cookies with me, and just freely looking at what would the future in terms of health for Kenyans look like. And we developed some of the most robust policies in just doing that. And, you know, when I look back, a couple of them were using that opportunity to be mentored. And they have since moved to different organizations. They are doing very well. We've kept in touch. Whenever they have issues that I think I can contribute, they'll speak to me. And because I'm coaching a handful of them, I also go to them. When I'm doing a technical piece that is touching on health and I think I want their input, they are telephone call away from me. And it's been a very fulfilling, you know, kind of relationship. In the youth space, I kind of had now tasted power as a principal secretary before I came into the youth docket. And then I came to the Ministry of Youth. I completely came down to be a youth myself. I stopped being, you know, a cabinet minister. I was in jeans. I was, you know, we danced our days away in the villages and we developed a very close bond that helped them. And every time I go back to the village, and I'm talking about in a village, not my village, and I find a young man coming to me and saying, you know, because of you, you remember that circle, you remember that youth circle, you challenged me, and now I am running my own aggregate in the village because of you. And then they had this brand name and they called me Mama Vijana, because I just was their mother. I wasn't their minister. That gives me a lot of joy. But also seeing how I was able to lead the team to grow the tea sector. We grew the tea sector in the time I was there from 47 billion to about 130 billion shillings inside 7 years. And that for me was, you know, was good because it meant money in the farmers' pockets. And I took a few daring moves that I'm documenting in the tea sector, you know, a few daring moves that almost costed me, but it's history because I'm still here.
You're still here. Thank God you're still here. Wow. I get a sense that you are self-motivated, you're self-driven, you're quite even inspired. So what keeps you that way? What keeps you so inspired about leadership and leadership matters?
So you are right, George. I am self-inspired because I'm self-driven because when I was in the private sector, I recall I resigned from a permanent pensionable parastatal job, which had given me a chance to travel the world as a very young, career person. But when I went to the private sector, it was a project that was 2 years. So I was assured of my salary for 2 years. And my then boss, who was a general manager, when I took my resignation letter, he called me and said, it was on a Friday. He said, "People don't resign from government. Okay. What people do, they ask for leave. And so I'm asking of you to take your letter back and bring it on Monday when you're asking for leave, and I will grant." And I told him, I think I have grown through very tough terrain. So if I come to you and tell you I want leave, it means where I'm going, I'm not going to put my best foot forward. So kindly allow that I resign and resign. I did. And again, I was the first one to resign from the parastatal. And I think I was not mistaken because then when I went on the other side, I knew I had to work so hard to have my contract renewed or for me to get another job. So I did. So I didn't look back. But when I went to that organization, my chairman, who's now still my very good friend, said to me, "You see, I'm coming from a secure parastatal space with structures. I am here now with a very scanty structure. Targets are very steep." And he said to me, "Cecily, you got to keep motivating yourself. You don't have people here to keep on telling you what to do and not to do." And so he re reinforced what I knew, that I have to drive myself. And I did drive myself because then that is what the nature is. So what keeps me like that? So is a bit of that background, but what keeps me that way is also to know, I think when you're given an opportunity to be in leadership, it is a privilege, it's not a right. And that if you are able to make a difference, which I believe every leader should be able to make, you should go all the way to make that difference. Big, small, large, any leader can make a difference. And therefore, that gives me the energy to keep doing that. But what gives me real satisfaction is when this young man or when this woman comes and says, "Because of you." When a medical doctor comes to me 4 years later and says, "This statement which you made, do you remember? You came to the boardroom and we were all sitting there and you made this statement," and he can quote verbatim. It means you left a long-lasting impression for him to want to be that kind of a leader. But keep on saying, "My kind of leadership is limiting. I want you to go beyond," because that was then. When they call and say, "Give us a session," I am invited to an international conference, and I haven't been to an international conference except when I joined you, in one of those meetings in Japan. When they call and now they are having that role, and I sit with them and I say, "By the way, you are the one who prepared my speaking notes, not so. So please convert that now. Those notes are yours." You see, so the template just follows me, and I get a lot of joy when I see this. And yeah, that keeps me going. But importantly, obviously, there is the family support. When they applaud you and say, "Keep going," and "Keep going," I feel very good about it.
You had mentioned, or you alluded that your mom and your dad had some influence on you on certain things. Who are some of the people maybe you can share, or what are some of the things that have influenced you in your leadership approach and style?
Both my parents, very humble. Like I said, there are seven of us. There are three gentlemen and there are three ladies plus me, four of us. My dad, given that he belongs to that other era, was very special because he believed that before him and my mom, we were equal. No boy, no girl, go for it. It was those days when girls would be ushered into early marriage, obviously. But my dad wanted you to go to the limit. It is those days when even FGM and girls would be exposed because of where you come from. But my dad was like, "No, You go to school and get it. I'll support all of you the same way. So that sense of equality is just very useful for people as they grow up, children as they grow up, treat them the same. Then I started being given responsibilities when I was very young. And, you know, my responsibilities were around minding. When everybody else went to the farm, I was left to take care of the home, to cook, to make sure everybody, you know, everyone is taken care of. And so I was responsible. I knew if food wasn't ready, then I was going to say what it is I was doing. And in between, I would go to climb trees, and in between, I would go to play. But food would still be ready. So I became a multitasker because I had to play. I had to go and play with the other girls, you know, in the neighborhood. Food had to. So I would multitask and make sure everything is together. By the time they are coming home, I would be settled and looking sheepish. But everything is in order, but I know where I've come from. But I also come from a very religious, if you will, family, where things like integrity, respect, you know, key value issues, and just giving back. If you have just a little more, share a bit of that. And, you know, those are some of the things. But hard work was real. Hard work was real. Hard work remains. You had to work. For you to enjoy good days on Christmas Day, you had to work. And that point, even if I was left to make sure home was okay, I still had to go to the coffee farm, because then I also want to be paid, because it would actually be paid. We'll be paid for the work you do, you know, by my mother. So that's where we've come from, George. Yeah.
And great training that embeds certain values, personal values, you know, hard work, the things that you're talking about. That's really, really good. Having traveled quite a bit the world, and even right now, even just seeing the opportunity that you're having to speak to African leaders, what do we need to do, Cicely, to fully enjoy and exploit the things that God has endowed this great continent of ours? You know, somebody said everything rises and falls with leadership. And for you, you have been, even in the public space, as a minister, interacting with people within the region and the continent. What do we need? What kind of leaders do we need to really exploit the great things God has put in this continent?
I mean, George, and to my thinking, we are so, so well endowed with everything, from climate to natural resources to good leaders, intelligent people like yourselves, committed leaders like yourselves. You know, everything that one would want to get in a continent, or in a country, if you are to look at Kenya again, is the continent. We have it here. But are we being good shepherds to what God has given us? My answer would be very mixed. Yes, to some extent, but I think that the gaps are more than what it is we are doing right. And I say this because of a few factors. I think that we are so drunk with power that you forget being in a leadership position is a privilege to serve, and to serve others, not to serve yourself. So we until and unless that you come and say, leadership is not equal to power. And I think that is what I see in maybe the developed world. That is why a title wouldn't bother me. I go to a lot of conferences and meetings, including one where I've just come from over the weekend in South Africa. And they say, so how do you want us to refer to you as honorable? I said, that is for the document and it's okay. But we are in this session. I think the title doesn't make a difference if I can make a difference to influence you or to inspire you. So the minute we move away from huge titles, because it's a symbol of power, shall we then come to where the people are and where the issues are? That's number one. Number two, the minute that we will be so hurt, the level of the growing inequality stops us from sleeping, from having a good night's sleep, is the minute we'll come and say, then what is good for George is good for Cicely, is good for John. And therefore, as a leader, you will wake up knowing one day your business is not just to meet a target. It is also to make sure there is a bit of leveling so that everybody has something to eat. When I left the public space, and one would feel very vulnerable, that because you've been used to having the security around you, I was so relieved that I didn't need armed guards at my gate. I won the one with the rungu because, and my husband thought I was losing something. Because if George, I owed you something when I was in the public space, then would I be concerned about having armed security in a way? And maybe this is sensitive. I'm not saying that so that they come. They shouldn't come. But the minute we are at a level of equality, then even those people who come to get it from us will be less motivated because we are more or less in an equal society until we wake up and begin framing the solution that will get us there. That is the other one. The other one, I think that for us as leaders, I have seen wrong decisions being made because I know it. I am the boss here. I know what we need. Therefore, do as I'm saying. And then a bad decision with negative repercussions is made. The minute the leaders will be able to say, I am okay without knowing who has the best idea to advise me, and I genuinely listen to the advisor and I take it in, then we'll say, as a country, then at that point, we will say that we're actually moving to the right trajectory. Then come back and say, and I've said it in several other occasions, what then Africa needs is emotionally intelligent leaders who are so self-aware of themselves and who are so aware of the so-called subjects that they are leading, that the two will converge and they will be able to then actually lead, not from a point of power, but from a point of wanting to make a difference. And I think that we are that point now, because I don't think that we can go below where we are. The question of governance in the continent, a leader is to enrich themselves or to serve, particularly the electorate, if you're an elected leader. The people who put you in are the people who are really your bosses. You should be concerned. And you shouldn't be concerned when you're going to vote hand the next round. And no wonder if you see the cycle that we are seeing in the continent, but also in our country, the turnover. If you last, you know, 5 years, you've done very well. Why? It's because you didn't serve the people. You have a promise. You have a committed. Then you come into this space and then you are not, you know, giving a hoot what's happening. And then you even talk arrogantly. Then you are not projecting any empathy. You are not feeling with the people. 2 years ago, you felt with the people. You could even cry with them when they cried, when you're looking for the votes. But right now, you know, so we are at that point. And this is more for the elected leaders. How about you and I? We are not in elective office, you know, positions, but we still have a role and responsibility. The more we can speak truth to power, I think the more we can also be part of the solution. The more we can collaborate to be a force that speaks, the more I think that we can also be useful to the people, because you and I are privileged to be in leadership positions, to have had experience and exposure, to gather local but also international experience. And therefore, we must be part of the solution. We can't say it is them and us, because we are guilty. When I resigned from cabinet, one of the very senior politicians said to me, and I was consulting because I was saying, am I committing suicide here or is it okay? And I had to consult quite deeply before I resigned. And she said to me, she's very senior, and she said to me, says if you don't resign now that you have a calling and you have a vision, never complain about poor governance in your village or in this country, never. So please go and resign. You know, so it was like the last stamp. Go and resign. I said, oh, okay. So I'm doing the right thing after all. My thinking is okay. So if you and I keep on saying it is a dirty sport, we then can't partake of it. We can't even influence what happens. We are comfortable in Nairobi. We don't go to the village to educate people when it's time to vote. You're as guilty as them. Thank you, George.
As guilty as them. We need to hear that. Well, thank you. If you are to sit down with a new leader, hearing your journey of 2 decades and wondering, how can I lead? How can I get where you are and beyond? What would be your advice to them?
I'll tell them that It's been done. I mean, it's been done by others, and the outcomes are either positive or negative, depending on the choices you make, because the outcomes that you get as a leader are choices that you make. And then you have to invest in the choices that you make. If you want to be an excellent leader, there are obvious tools, techniques, and strategies that you need to follow, starting by just being self-aware of who you are. What are your limitations? What are your strengths? And which path do you want to follow? Number two, I think that the minute you find yourself in that position, it's fair for you to start relooking your legacy or what you exist for and what you want to for people, the other generation to come and know you for, and the footprint that you want to leave. Number three, I will be very, very quick to remind them that it's not about them. It's about the subject that they serve, and therefore, waking up every morning, carrying the burden of the people that you serve or you lead is so important and should be your guiding star. But I'll also say to them, I think, unlike when we got started as CEOs, the template was yours. You had no reference point. You had no guide by way of either a coach. Mentors were not necessarily mentors. And unfortunately, we are the children or the product of command and control systems. Do it as I say, I am the boss. And in my own case, I remember coming up with a novel, you know, idea in the space where I was. And, you know, spending a whole weekend consulting away from office and taking what I thought was a solution my way to the boss. And he asked me, who told you? Nana Likutuma, who sent you, you know, to do this? That is a point at which I knew I may not survive long in that organization, because then every idea must be, I know it, I'm the boss, so you do it. So they are very lucky. This CEO I'm sitting with in this season is very lucky, because I have seen the space of leadership coach or coaches being embraced with more appetite, with more acceptance, and you don't feel bad like you don't know. I've also seen the space of advisors growing, and therefore, if you surround yourself with people who are equally smart as this CEO that I am guiding, you're likely to get up with better emotional reasoning and better, you know, decision making with less effort. I've also seen, because of the explosion of the internet and the technological advancement, I've also seen there are a lot of sources of credible reference material that you can refer yourself to as a CEO, so that your decision-making lead time is a lot shorter. In a nutshell, I'm saying that I think it's in terms of sources of information or reference or, you know, benchmarking, there's a lot of more accessibility and you know, solutions being proposed. But equally, flipping it the other way around, the risk is higher because of the volatility, the complexity that we see. And therefore, for you as a CEO, you want to feel comfortable making decisions before you have been caught up with paralysis through analysis and paralysis. They go together. You know, over researching, you must be wanting to take a shorter lead time to make decisions because of the speed that we find ourselves into. And that can also be risky. And that is why surrounding yourself with advisors and other people, coaches, mentors, becomes a lot easier. So it can be done. I would want to assume that this CEO, if they were to be, you know, coached by me or advised by me, I would want them to think, to start by thinking of the end and then working backwards to where we are currently. Their legacy, the impact, what makes the team function, and so on and so forth. And then you work into fitting that, as opposed to waking up to go and be told, because we are no longer going to see a command and control, you know, kind of leadership style.
True. That style, that traditional style can't survive right now with what is happening. So in terms of, I know at the beginning you had alluded to the kind of legacy you want to have, and even with your new organization, maybe just articulate to us, when you think of your legacy, how does it look like?
Sicily and the legacy. So reimagine impact. I'd want to have a positive impact that makes part of my footprint whenever I serve or whomever I interact with. I would want them 5 years from now to maybe do a mail short and say, because of the interaction I had with you, whether in whichever capacity, that because of that, I got thinking about leadership or about my management style differently. And therefore, you know, I will have impacted that kind of a person that I interact with. So I think impact for everything that I do, I think impact because it's important. But I would also want somebody plotting or reading my story then, and I don't want it soon. It is now when I am gone, but I don't want it soon. I still have.
Sure.
I want them to say we came across a leader who was trustworthy and honest because of the dealings that she transacted. And that even when the pressure was, you know, so huge, she would still say, I'm all right, because when is enough enough when it comes to money? So I want somebody to say, I am not driven by money as a means. I want money as a means to something, but I don't want money for the sake of. Therefore, I'm not going to partake of things which bring my integrity to question. Whether in active elective politics, whether in whatever it is I'm doing, I want somebody to plot and say that is who she was. But I also want to say she believes in proper intergenerational transitioning, and I'm deliberate about growing the leaders who are behind me through empowering them, through role modeling, through challenging them, and through being available for them. Because half the time, you and I will not be available for these people. And we always think there's something the matter with the younger generation, the Z, the millennial, and whoever is going to come after that. And therefore, we don't spend enough time with them to understand them, to listen to them, because we think we know. I want to be down on record as having created time to listen to these people and to help them become better than I, and perhaps carry a better value system than I've seen in our generation.
Yeah, well said. So if we are to wrap up and you are to say and answer this question, so your wonderful leadership story that's quite inspiring, what's the moral of it?
I think that you as a leader, you need to be your own person. I'm my own person. The principles that guide effective leadership or great leadership are all the same, but I'm unique in the way I execute and exercise leadership, because I am not going to follow a template that I think is misaligned with any other leader. And therefore, I am the author of my leadership journey and story, legacy, impact, and what have you. It is me. I am in the driver's seat.
Well said, driver's seat. I like that. Your final thoughts and comments before we say goodbye, Cicely?
We've talked quite a bit, George, but I just thought in terms of where I find myself, and because I have been asked, what are you doing on social media, by the way? A whole cabinet minister.
Yes.
Well, what is this you're doing?
Yeah.
I mean, they haven't even seen the last of me on social media, the ones who are concerned, because society puts you in a box and predetermines your behavior and how you show up. Society. I think I said you should be your own person, because then you shouldn't allow what is held as norms within a certain class to hold you from being you. And, you know, being in the present, enjoying what you do, expressing it, rebranding, and doing all this. So I am in the social media spaces myself because I'm choosing to be my own person. I'm choosing to be the leader the way I know how. And therefore, I continue to be in the social media. I'll continue to be vulnerable, be okay with my limitations, because I know them. But I'll continue to tap into networks of experts like you in different spaces so that I can also reduce the lead time to be able to do what it is I need to do. I'll, of course, continue to be in networking and social spaces. I'll continue to volunteer because it is in doing these things that you learn to be a better leader. You know, it is what helps me to deal with my limitations. So I'll continue to be my own person. How I wish that we can accelerate the uptake of leadership coaching and emotional intelligence up as a skill and its uptake within our country, because it means we are able to actually bring some of the concerns that we are seeing to a point of being deliberated and to a point of being resolved if we all were to build collective emotional intelligence as leaders. So whether you're in politics or you're on the other side, my motivation to move into this space originally was for me to impact the public sector spaces. They are proving very difficult. But you see, if you, I, the other person, was speaking towards those pockets, I think that we can find faster movement to impact. Because you and I can do our thing, we are limited how much you can do. I truly, truly want to appreciate you, George, for this session. There's so much to talk about, but I really thank you for the opportunity as well.
Thank you, Cicely. As I said before we started, I admire you. You're one of the leaders, you know, at the top level of government who has come out and redefined and still found a space to be relevant and impactful. So I commend you for that. It's really, really admirable. And keep up your good work, and we'll keep connecting. And me, I'm also in social media, so we'll keep connecting even at that level. Thank you very much for honoring us.
Thank you for joining us in today's podcast. We hope you're leaving with insights that will help you live and lead better. We appreciate our sponsors, BNG Consultants Limited and BNG Center for Leadership Coaching, for keeping us on air. Bye for now. See you in our next episode.